Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We appreciate y'all joining us for another Summer Solstice Free-for-All Live here on Midrats. And just for a reminder, for those that are with us live, because if you're getting the podcast, you can't do the following. But this is an opportunity where if there's a topic that you would like for us to address that we haven't addressed so far this year and have let you down, couple things you can do. You can roll into the chat room down at the bottom of the page. We'll be monitoring then that during the course of the show. And if you have some questions or some topics you'd like for Eagle One and myself to address, that's a great place to put it. Or if you're not an introvert wallflower and you would actually like to throw your voice amongst the interwebs, you can give us a call right here at the show switchboard. We are at area code 347-308-8397, 347-308-8397. We'd love to hear your questions, and we will do our best to answer it, or if we find it uncomfortable, we will avoid it at all possible costs. Eagle One, good afternoon.
Hey, Sal. What kind of valuable prizes do we have for our guests today?
our undying affection and a free 48-hour Liberty chip to be taken over any holiday weekend. No problem at all. Hey, I thought we'd kick it off because people are going to expect for us to talk, because it really is the, it's like somebody you know having a heart attack. It's just part of life. It happens on a regular basis, but you don't know when it's going to happen or who it's going to happen to. But recently in our Navy family, we've seen another collision at sea. Of course, I'm talking about the USS Fitzgerald Flight 1 DDG 51 class. Kind of what we were talking about in the pre-show, the Mother Ocean's really big until she's not, and things get really tight. And you've actually had the challenge of doing something I have not, and that's coming in to Tokyo Harbor, Eagle One. There's been a lot of rabid speculation out there about what may have happened in the micro. We've got a real good man running the JAG man, so I think we'll know more than we probably wanted to know when they're through doing that with what they release. But there are some broad generalities that I think we would be remiss if we didn't take the opportunity just to bring up and chat a bit about, because it is universal when it comes to operating at sea, whether you're a civilian mariner or military. And in Eagle One, you've actually made the approach in there to Tokyo. So talk a little bit about what you know from the bridge heading into that body of water.
Well, first, I think we need to take a second to honor the seven young men, I think, who died during that incident. And one of them apparently worked really hard to try and save as many people as he could and managed, ended up dying himself. So I think we really need to acknowledge their lives and send our respects to their various families. But, it's a tragedy, and I'm sure the investigation will reveal a lot more than all the idle speculation that any one of us or has already been so much speculation already that it's difficult to add to it. Everything from the ship that the merchant ship was on a automatic pilot, and there's that weird U-turn they did. There's all kinds of stuff that goes on. Let me say that a lot of what goes on in the ocean, the middle of the ocean, can be very uncrowded. As one commentator on the Fitzgerald incident said, was that he had been on the ocean and never seen another ship for 2 or 3 weeks, and I've had that happen. And then as you get to major ports, things get crowded. And not only is Tokyo a major port, but you've got all kinds of fishing traffic and other stuff going out there. It can be a very confusing place. I remember going in there. It was one of the first, I think it might have been one of my first OD watches, actually. And your radar screen in those days, the little round thing, instead of what they're using now, got white with contacts. Like, you know, you had to stay out and keep an eye on things. And everybody was trying to time the same thing. Nobody wanted to go into that port at night. So everybody hangs around out there outside waiting for dawn so they can head into the Tokyo Bay. And it's a very challenging environment, and you've got to pay a lot of attention. So again, it points out the same thing. Any major port, Hong Kong, Tokyo, Singapore, there's a whole lot of traffic. You know, New York, there's San Francisco, there's a whole bunch of traffic out there that you just have to be really conscious of, and it requires a great deal of, on everybody's part, a great deal of patience and familiarity with the area. Now, I think that Fitzgerald was one of the forward deployed ships, so they probably had more familiarity with the area than those of us who just kind of wandered in every now and then. But it's a tragedy. It's I'm sure it'll be thoroughly investigated, and we'll know a lot more. But it's kind of like your after action reports on any kind of aviation accident. You know, it's easy to speculate. Everybody thinks they know something, but doesn't necessarily mean that what they know or what they think they know is exactly right. And I was kind of offended by some comments made on G Captain. Normally the G Captain people are pretty good, but you know, the idea that the Navy crews are not as good as merchant crews because the training is different, I fundamentally disagree with that, but you know, that's one guy's opinion. So
I was kind of taken a bit back by that as well. I was surprised that they went there, so to speak. It's way too early, those guys over at G Captain, especially the gentleman who wrote that, I don't know what caused him to go there that early, but there's plenty of time for that. And I think it's way too preliminary to be throwing that around. Unfortunate, but not unexpected. Maybe there's anyway. I'm not going to speculate on the man's motivation. I just think he's premature. The things that we're going to find out, just from a structural standpoint, you know, the Arleigh Burks. I had pulled this up before the show, but there was a quote by Arleigh Burke Actual. I believe it was at the commissioning or the christening of Hull 1. You know, these ships were built to fight. You better be one of those things. I mean, obviously, as a warship, it's a DDG, but it's a robust ship. We saw what's happened with the coal, the fact that she wasn't stuck. I mean, speaks volumes to the designers of the ship and, of course, the crew and the efforts they made to keep her afloat. But when the first picks come out of Fitzgerald in dry dock, I think the results of that bulbous bow hitting below the waterline is kind of like the visual people had of the coal once she was hauled out of the water. And another unfortunate bit of pontification by a few people who really should know better. I mean, they're not from the Navy side of the house, but they're one email away from talking to people who were. People need to remember that for the first few thousand years of naval warfare, the primary method of attack was ramming, especially if you have a ram under the water. Ships, especially those ships, not necessarily the Arleigh Burke class, but some ships that have very little freeboard, you don't have to take on much water before you're in a significant amount of problems. So I think part of the Jagman and part of the post-deck that we're going to get on that are the efforts that the crew at the Fitzgerald made to dewater, get her stabilized, and get her back to port. It'll be interesting to see what additional work will need to be done in order to get her back in shape. And I did maybe we'll touch on it later on, but I did that little post over at USNI blog earlier this week about the three X's. And when you build new ships, you often look back at what worked and what didn't work at previous classes of ship. And one of the challenges that the U.S. Navy have, and really all navies have, is we do not have in the last few decades actual combat experience that can help inform designs, modifications, and things to avoid in warships. I know we've learned a lot from the Cole, and hopefully as we move forward to design new classes of warships, we'll have the 100-pound head ship designers and marine engineers look at the damage that was done here to this ship. Be able to incorporate some of those lessons in the future designs so we can at least derive some positive aspects for the future for the sacrifice that was made after this collision.
Yeah, it's, I think that as thing goes on, people are going to have to really accept the fact that one of the good news side of it, if there is such a good thing in a collision like that, is that the crew, many of whom were asleep, let's say that they're on a three-section watch, you had two-thirds of the crew asleep, and they saved the ship. They got their act together, and it could have gone a lot worse than it did had it not been for the efforts of the crew. So be easy to them for their efforts. And can you imagine? I mean, it's like somebody driving a truck into your house at 2 a.m. and then you have to fight the fire that's caused by the truck hitting your house. Now that would be a bit much, and it's a lot to ask of these young men and women on these ships. But they got it together and saved the ship, so that's good.
I think another. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, go ahead.
Now, the timing I think is auspicious too. If you want to be, totally cold-hearted about it, which if you knew my personality type, it isn't too hard of a stretch. A thing to consider is there's been a lot of discussion recently about autonomous surface ships and these great merchant ships plowing the seas unmanned. And usually when you see it, they're out there in the wide open ocean, which again is big until it isn't. But it does lead some questions, being that some of the preliminary information says that the ship that hit the Fitzgerald was on autopilot. That's what took it a while to adjust. And it kept trying to go to its point even after it made impact. That I think that should, as the morning ends, it should inform the discussion about autonomous surface ships. And what is the wisdom of that? You know, there's a wisdom to be minimally manned, but do you really want these huge 27,000-ton ships plowing around your ports without a human being looking out the bridge? I think human error and all, there is a lot more hard questions need to be answered before we can really be comfortable with that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and one we probably will be discussing down the road. One of the other highlights, I guess, if you will, of the week, or last few days, has been the shooting up of the SU-22 by the one of the Golden Warriors of VFA 87, and first time, I guess, the first air kill by the U.S. since 1999. You're an air type. What's your view of that kind of activity?
Geez, it's executive summary for our. Our fellow military professionals worldwide, when the U.S. tells you don't go someplace, don't go someplace. You're going to get taken out. And I think that I'm not trying to be political here. I'm just trying to be matter of fact here. There's a reason why people want to call our bluff. Are we talking? Are we serious? Is this a red line or is this a rose line or a pink line or a dashed line or a virtual line or is this a conversational line? I think there's a little bit of re-education that needs to go on that when the U.S. says something, it means it. So please don't do it. And unfortunately, I think the pilot of that SU-22, which at any air show probably would sit down and have a few beers and have some good stories with the F-18 pilot, he was ordered to go do something. And he did it, and he paid the price before people decided to call the bluff. I wouldn't read too much more into it besides that. The SU-22 is an old platform, and the version the Syrians are flying are about as basic as a first or second run production of an F-5, if you wanted to draw the line. I think what it called out to me on, though, something that I was hoping that the previous administration would do, and I don't know to what extent, because I probably shouldn't know, what the present administration is doing. There's nothing that says that we and Russians and Syrians have to be enemies if we can define our common goals at this stage of the game, which I think should be, as SecDef Mattis has said, is the annihilation of the Islamic State, the full investment of their capital, and let Raqqa get the same treatment Mosul will. I think Raqqa's end game is going to be a lot more brutal than what we see in Mosul, simply because of all the philosophical and religious underpinning of why they're in Raqqa. But there's no reason why we can't deconflict better than we've had, so we don't have any more of these incidents. There's no reason why we need to be shooting down Syrian aircraft unless they do what we tell them not to do. And there's definitely no reason why we should shrug our shoulders at or not be extremely cautious towards something unfortunate happening with the Russians. Now, I know most of the Russians are in the western part of Syria taking care of their national interests, which is fine. They're a sovereign nation. They're allowed to. But hopefully we're taking steps to deconflict what we need to do. Of course, that begs the question, where do we go once the Islamic State is done in Raqqa? I know my preference would be that we get the hell out of there and let the locals work it out. But that's for better and wiser men to decide than me.
Well, I'm certain there was a level of signaling in there in the sense that, from what I gather, just from reading unclassified sources, you know, there was a group of, not a group, there are always F-18s. After a while, there were F-18s cycling through the area where these the people the U.S. are supporting were during their operations, They warned the Syrians not to fly there, and then it was fairly obvious that the Syrians knew that the U.S. had aircraft there, and yet they still went and flew in there. And from reports I've seen, and I don't know whether these are true or not, the F-18s did a pretty thorough job of trying to discourage this guy before they finally decided they had to take him out. So. You know, but how much of this is, and I think you're right, I think a lot of this is, you know, a testing of a new administration. You know, are you really giving the green light to do things that that the old administration would say they were going to do and didn't do? And I think that has been answered at this point pretty well. Speaking of administrations, though, I see that Jerry Hendricks has said, let's talk about the new Secretary of the Navy, prospective Secretary of the Navy. What do you know about Mr. Spencer?
I know he's a smart guy. I know that he knows a lot of other smart guys. And I know that his to-do list is already quite, I don't know how many megabytes it is, but if he is at a rather interesting inflection point for SecNav. If there is somebody that really wants to put their stamp on the Navy, really wants to have long-term positive impact on the Navy and the maritime service, now's the time to do it. I just wish him a great staff. I wish him good partners in the Hill, because let's be honest here, you can talk and theorize and produce as many PowerPoints and as many position papers and keep think tanks working till 23:30, six nights a week. But if you don't have the money coming out of Congress, you're not going to get much done. And that ultimately is going to see how that partnership develops. I think it's exciting. I would really like him to get into play simply so we can look at who he's going to be hiring. Who is he going to bring on his team? People is policy. And he's going to signal, I think, to a lot of people which direction he's going to want to by the people that, that he brings on board. And that also, something I've been thinking about a lot the last few weeks, kind of torques me off, is there are a lot of people who are throwing spitballs at the present administration, the national security and diplomatic arenas for not filling many positions. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that what probably looked good and felt good at the time is turning out to be a huge strategic mistake of national implications, where a lot of really good, really smart people and a position in a point of personal pique decided to say things about the present administration before the election at such point that it's kind of hard to hire them, even if they wanted the job. And so there's a limited pool of people that the present administration can rely on. And if you look at least inside my noggin, you got to be very careful who you're hiring, because there's a new game in town of who's going to leak what and where. And I think the acting FBI director put out a great notice a couple of weeks ago that FBI is going after him, and that's great. There's no reason why anybody with a GS or an SES next to their line, much less anybody in uniform, should be leaking to anybody. And so I think things are going to go slow with the administration as they continue to hire people, because they have a more limited right-of-center crowd to pick from, unfortunately. And they've got to be careful who they pick. They pick people that are going in for the right reasons and the right motivations, who they can trust. That's going to take time, and we don't have much time. I think politically minded people are smarter than me, but I think we've got, it's end of June right now. So we've got about 4 or 5 more months until the 2018 election cycle starts and everything gets gummed up from there. How about you?
Yeah, I don't really know that much about him. I know he was a Marine aviator and that he lives in Wyoming, which, you know, I think both of which are positive things as far as I'm concerned. He does have a lot of stuff, I think, potentially on his plate. And, you know, we probably ought to talk about some of that stuff, because you've already addressed a lot of it, as you said, with your XXX. You know, where are those new designs for the ships that we know we're going to need? And also, you know, questions about our aircraft. Again, you know, we're so dependent on the F-18 right now. You know, is it smart for us to bring back S-3s? Is it smart for us to continue to develop the I want to call it a drone tanker, but you know, UAV tanker, in addition to all the other UAV stuff we got going on? I mean, and you know, what's more important for us these days, submarines or surface ships? And where should our dollars go? And is this guy a good enough salesman to convince Congress to spend the money that we need to have the Navy where it should be?
And that's where he needs that partnership on the Hill. He has to have a gaggle of people that are on his team for the right reasons. There are a lot of people who are throwing darts about the latest lack of a better phrase, defense budget, the money allocated to defense, where, you know, where's the big shipbuilding? No, we need a year or two to work on readiness, work on repair, get what we have working right. There are a few things we can do that I haven't, because everybody wants to talk about, which is, it's a fun topic. Believe me, I love talking about alternatives to LCS. You know, hey, can we bring what Perrys we have left that, you know, maybe we can get an extra decade of service life out of them to do either the upgrade the Turks did, or maybe the upgrade that the Australians did with theirs, which actually makes a 32 evolved Sea Sparrow missiles on a ship like that, along with a one-armed bandit modified to take SM-2 is a pretty sexy combo that you could find some good use for 10 years while you try to get your act together or license building something. But something near and dear to your heart, and I know if Lee was here, he would be banging the gong. But if, I don't know anybody that says we have too many replenishment ships. I don't think we have too many. We sure as use your sailor verbiage however you want to right now, have enough icebreakers. A nation such as ours, a premier maritime power, having one functional icebreaker is a national tragedy. We, you know, we've called it the unsexy but important. Our command ships are as old as me. That's ludicrous. And they've shown their value over and over and over and over again in a variety of ways. Hospital ships the same way. You know, there are some ships that we, in addition to designs already in place for, quote, warships, unquote, that we need to put people to work building. And I don't see enough people talking about the unsexy but important. But I know Jerry is with us here in the chat room today. And I'll go back to one of his touchstones, influence squadrons. Whether or not we're going to be challenged on the high seas by Russia or China or combined, you know, let's take the other path and say that we're going to see a few more decades of aggressive cooperation and competition at sea and peace. Those ships will do a lot for our, lack of a better phrase, influence squadron, partnering and working around the globe that I would really love to see some new construction on. I know it's not sexy to talk about. Maybe there are some smart people in the background digging through the couches in the Pentagon looking for enough shekels to be able to put a couple into production. But hopefully that's part of the plan when hopefully SecNav Spencer gets in place, gets his team in place, and some bags of cash show up at the front door in the morning they can start building stuff with.
Yeah, that would be nice. And yeah, it's the replenishment world, logistics support world is probably not as big as we want it to be. Although, you know, the numbers, when you look at them in terms of the size of the fleet compared to, say, back in the days of the Tonkin Gulf Yacht Club, they're not that far off on a per ship basis than what we had when we had, 700, 900 ships out there. The question always is for us is the distance. You know, we have time distance problems. Our shorelines are far away from a lot of places we want to do our work, and that requires either us to use a lot of ships in a train going across the ocean so that we always have somebody on station that's got all the stuff we need, or having good logistics base. We were lucky during the Vietnam War that we had Subic Bay, and it was a tremendous facility, and we were quite active there. And we have Guam now and some stuff I know in Japan. But, you know, it's if things got hot and heavy, and Lord knows I hope that they don't, it's going to be interesting to see how we can logistically sustain a force of the size, even now that we have out there doing full operations. And we don't want to go, you know, all Libya and be shrugging the shoulders when somebody asks us where the ordnance is that we didn't seem to be able to get in place in time.
Absolutely.
At least I don't.
I mean, I don't have to tell anybody in our audience this. The Pacific is huge. And modern technology, and you don't have to be a fiction writer, Claude. Hello in the chat room, Claude. in order to create two or three scenarios where something happens at Westpac and Japan goes, not today, guys, thanks. And by the way, you can't use my ports. You can't use my airfields, et cetera, and so forth. Not to mention everything Guam and in could be vulnerable. And you go back to the last time we had to fight in the Pacific without all those nice, friendly bases like we did in Vietnam. Yeah, you look at the Neo Show, who was during the Battle of Leyte Gulf, almost as important as the carriers and everybody else, and she wound up being taken out by accident. That's sober, and I know it's been war-gamed, but a lot of assumptions out there that we're going to have access to X and Y, and as anybody who war-games likes to do, show me your assumptions and give me two for me to prove false. So let me see your branch plan form. It's always a fun exercise to go through. And speaking of plan, something else that has been kind of a burr in my saddle recently, and a lot of this happens to do with some of the left-to-center people I follow on Twitter because I'm a masochist. Everybody is screeching and yelling about we've increased just a few thousand additional advisors and trainers for Afghanistan. Where's the plan? They know better. Last administration came into office. Their initial team with Holbrook and his band of merry men came to visit and started chewing on it in January. The plan was an autopilot till the end of December 2009, and no substantial changes were made until later on in 2010. So we're actually seeing movement with this administration faster than we saw movement with the previous administration. I think we will see all that we want to see come the December 17 through April 18 timeframe with what the new administration wants to do in Afghanistan. There are people who say, well, we should just leave. We've talked about that a few times here. I think that's premature, but anybody who thinks it's going to be easy, whether you stay there or if you try to find the nearest friendship bridge to drive your APC across, have some patience. We'll see the plan and quit throwing spitballs.
Yeah, I think that's right. You were talking about Guam now being potentially within range of some bad guys. And that, of course, raises the issue of North Korea and their recent activities. Can we rely on Guam? Do we have enough ballistic missile defense capability to handle what the North Koreans could throw out? Is there, and, you know, the other side of it is, we're not looking at a World War II scenario. We're looking at, I think what we used to call major regional contingency, maybe. And is there enough, do we have enough stuff to support that operation, assuming that we do have ports like Singapore and some places in Japan available to us? So what's your thought on North Korea and the threat that they currently pose to us?
Oh, God, talk about frozen conflicts. Everybody knows that we just have an armistice right now. I think the one thing this administration has gotten right to this point, and I'd love to have heard the conversations behind the cipher door, China is the ultimate solution here. People need to remember that after the first year, well, not even first year of the war, but after the initial kickoff of the war, a lot of the Korean War was the U.S. versus China. The Chinese have a lot of their own concerns with North Korea involving stability, and believe it or not, a nation that big. I've read a few things about their paranoia, about their Korean minority. I don't know if that's too much of a concern. I don't see a threat that a lot of people see with North Korea. I see a hermit kingdom, highly insecure, with some great mid-20th century technology to develop some nuclear weapons with mid-late 20th century rocket technology. People need to remember what we have to do and had done, and the French and the Russians and even the Chinese about in order to know whether they actually have a viable nuclear capability. That's taking a no-kidding rocket with a dummy warhead and launching it at full range and then seeing how close you get to your target and doing that over and over and over again. I don't see any type of first strike with nuclear weapons in the foreseeable future coming from North Korea. The greater danger for North Korea is the fact that they do not have the most stable leadership in the world. If they can keep that instability internal, I think besides dealing with their hissy fits, we should keep an open line with China. And if something needs to be done, the Chinese and the South Koreans should be the two to be talking about it. And we can sit in the back of the room and back South Korea's action. But I'm not comfortable, nor do I think it's appropriate in 2017 for the U.S. being the prime mover on this. Because ultimately, it's millions of South Koreans who are going to face the brunt. There's going to be millions of Chinese that would have their life affected because of waves of refugees and unrest and instability on their borders that are going to be affected. The Japanese have concerns there as well. We have our treaty obligations, but I think ultimately we need to defer to the Chinese and the South Koreans to deal with the Hermit Kingdom as long as they can keep themselves internally. I know I may be in the minority here. The genie's out of the bottle with them having nuclear weapons, but them having something that actually is operationally functional. If they tried to nuke Guam, odds are it'd never make it there, even if nobody touched it. And then the fun part is they try to attack Guam, and instead the nuke goes off 300 kilometers to the northeast in the middle of nowhere. Okay, now what do you do? So, I'm not too worried in 2017. Talk to me again in 2027. Maybe I'll have a different opinion. But right now, we got plenty of time and space.
Well, one of the things that disturbs me, we've got to figure out what to do with China. I mean, China, we want China to be a friendly force in dealing with the North Koreans, but we want China to back, and you know, which gives them a certain amount of credit for power over their neighbors, a neighbor, a former, certainly they support them during the Korean War, but then we also want them to back off in the South China Sea and not put pressure on some of their former allies and other events. Is there a mixed message to China, or is this just big powers, elephants dancing around on the world stage?
I bet it's both. I think one of the more fascinating things that I've heard a couple of China hands talk about is the Chinese Communist Party, in a few ways, has lost a firm grip around the throat of the PLA and the Navy and their Air Force. And you've got different power structures now with different views of what China should do that are cross currents. I think the Chinese are going to try to bluff and bully their way into every square meter they can. And as long as nobody's there to stop them, I don't think they're going to go to war over it, but they'll scare the hell out of you to do that. Then they'll do it. They've got a lot of – they have a short window to get enough wealth and security to be able to maintain the support of the people. Rapidly aging population, that's going to result in lower productivity. They don't have a high standard of living as is. If the Chinese people all of a sudden lose faith in their government, they have a history of mass action. And ultimately, the Chinese Communist Party is concerned with all political parties, the maintenance of power. They don't have other parties to compete with, so it's their own internal factions and their own people they have to be concerned with. Now, does the South China Sea help feed a little bit of nationalist enthusiasm for some of their population? Sure. Does it give them the potential to access resources that helps them mitigate their reliance? This will sound familiar to hydrocarbon resources, a.k.a. oil and gas in the Middle East? Sure, it does. Does it also nourish their grievance and egos? Absolutely, it does. So I think the potential is there, but ultimately, the Chinese are more interested in pushing as hard as they can diplomatically, informationally, and economically than they are militarily in the South China Sea. We just need to make sure that they don't overreach and cause one of our friends to do something that's going to be hard to back out of for either party.
Yeah, it's China has an interesting history, and the more I read, the more sanguine I get, I guess is the best phrase, about what they're really about. You know, they're not really an aggressor nation in the same sense as somebody moving troops into, let's just say the Ukraine or into half of Eastern Europe. They're much more slow. They're slower than that. It's a glacier instead of a lightning strike. So that their influence is it's almost like the Borg. You know, you will be assimilated. So and that's how they, you know, that's the history. If you go back and look at the way they treat, you know, they were the Middle Kingdom because they were the Middle Kingdom. I mean, everybody played homage to them. So, kind of an interesting history, and I think we still see that being played out. I think that they want to gain that role back, plus protect, as you said, their economic viability by having their one road, one whatever the part of that is, one road, one path, one, yeah. So one belt, yeah. I don't know where that belt comes from, but okay.
Thank you very much.
So I think that's kind of where they are. And, I think Right Cow on the left coast does point out the good point. You know, they killed all their women babies, and that's going to be an interesting problem for them down the road.
India has the same problem in a lot of their regions, where I think the worst is 1.25, 1.27 male to every female child. That's, you have two of the largest nations in the world that have that type of imbalance. I don't know, some sociologist is going to have to invest a lot of time in that. And I think I need both a sociologist, a psychologist, a diplomat, and maybe somebody with a Ouija board to explain to me. Maybe you could help me, my illustrious co-host. What is going on the Arabian Peninsula where everybody has decided to gang up on Qatar? I think it's a little overdue in many regards, because we all know what they've done for supporting terror. They, like Saudi Arabia, are a Wahhabist, but they've been an enlightened Wahhabist, if there is such a thing. Did the Arab world just trip onto something? Or is there a larger thing going on here inside of the coalition that, oh, by the way, is fighting the Yemen civil war, but all of a sudden they're all turning on Qatar right now?
Yeah, I've read conflicting reports. One was that, you know, the Bahrainis were pointing the finger at Qatar as the source of some of their internal problems. And then I read something else that said that that was all based on some, if you will, fake news. And that wasn't really the case, but I don't know. I see the U.S. doing what I would think is the sound policies, that we're good friends with Qatar and we're good friends with everybody else that we choose to be good friends with there. So we're just going to ignore their internal strife and see how things shake out, I think.
Yeah, I would like to get a demographer to help me out here too, because what's the latest butcher's bill in Syria? Isn't it somewhere like 400,000, 350 to 500,000? Nobody really knows how many have been killed in that nation. And one of the real demographic explosions people were talking about, and I think we actually talked about here in the early years of the show, we've been doing it 7.5 years, believe it or not, was, you know, Yemen itself, huge birth rate. But as that civil war grinds on, don't know when that's all said and done, you know, how many people would be killed in that? Qatar's a small nation, Bahrain's even smaller, but I think the big danger there is what Qatar shares, a little lesser extent than Bahrain does, is the majority of the population are Shia and are friends with Iran. That whole world decides to bag itself and you get into a Saudi-Iranian conflict. I don't see any quick end to any of those wars. It's going to be kind of like the Iran-Iraq war, that there are parts of it that are very modern, but the majority of it is just old-school butchery.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's when you get into religious wars, even within the same religion, and I know you are somewhat of Irish ancestry, but you know, with those of us who come from French Huguenot backgrounds and stuff, I mean, you know, it gets ugly, and it gets ugly and stays ugly, and there are a lot of long memories from those wars. You and I talked before about, you know, in Kosovo, they were still worried about an event that happened, 600 years ago, and they speak of it like it was yesterday, you know. So I don't know how that all sorts out. I know that Iran, you know, is fighting a proxy war in Yemen. They're fighting, you know, literally, they're fighting on the ground in Syria. You know, they've got their fingers dipped well into Iraqi politics, and Qatar's trying to get along with Iran, and that may, you know, that always irritates people like the Saudis. So, you know, how do you keep peace among all the neighbors in a relatively small neighborhood like that? And if you look at your own neighborhood and the houses around you, you know, there are neighbors you talk to, neighbors you don't like, neighbors you've never talked to, you know, and it's like that, except that everybody has guns and other things. So
hopefully nobody starts shooting anybody over it. I thought one of the weirdest twists to this whole equation was, out of the blue, the Turks said, "Hey, we're going to go set up a base in Qatar." I'm like, okay, that's nice. That's interesting. I guess it does kind of go with the neo-Ottoman meme. But when you go back over and over again, you know, how many conflicts do you have between the Turks and the Persians? And a lot of people don't realize that, you know, right down the road there over in Oman, Omanis have always been very pro-Iranian, simply because the Iranians are Shia, and for the Wahhabists, the religion of the royal family and most of the Omanis is considered heretical, just like it is with the Assad and the Alawites up there in Syria. I don't know how much we can not be involved in that, how much we can adjust on the margins, but I don't share people's worry that we were going to try to fix everything, because I think we've learned over the course of the last 15 years that's not our skill set in that part of the world. But that may be one of the big challenges for us, is to try to maintain the friendships as best as we can, try to stop one side or the other from going too far, but really to stay as disengaged as we can, because I don't see how we could do anything to really promote our national interest outside of continuing to develop for us and our friends fracking ability. So if that place does implode, we can still put gas in our cars and keep our buildings warm in winter with the energy.
Yeah, as you were talking, I actually wrote down fracking, and it raised the issue that somebody talked about earlier about, you know, the effects of the crisis in Venezuela. And a lot of that is driven by the fact that, you know, as the U.S. nears energy independence, and in this case, it's not the wind farms and the magic, things on your roof that gather electricity, all that stuff. It's none of that, you know. It is fracking. It is Yeah, solar panels. Sorry, my brain today. Solar panels. You know, that's not the way it works. Fracking has worked. We've got more gas and oil than we've ever had. We're beginning to export it, which is pissing Russia off. You know, because now I think the first delivery of LNG was delivered to Poland here recently, and you know, that's going to shake up that market a lot, I think. So. If I'm Japan, I'm looking to the U.S. and Canada and saying, hey, you guys, you know, I don't really need to worry about Middle East oil. If you guys will help me out a little bit, and if I'm some of the other countries in that part of the world that, you know, they're worried about China encroaching in the South China Sea and somehow controlling shipping lanes, you know, I think that this frees up a lot of stuff that we ought to be really taking a positive look at. And in the meantime, some of these countries are so dependent on selling their petroleum products to the West at a high price, as fracking has dropped the price and U.S. fracking operators have learned to live with lower prices for their products. This has got to be driving these high living states like the Saudis and some of the other ones nuts, because there's nothing they can do about what the U.S. is doing, which is completely shaking up the energy market.
And I think that's one of the – it's easy sometimes to get caught up in the negativity and the apocalypse of the moment and stuff. But we're both old enough to remember, you know, how many times have people talked about peak oil – and the world's running out of energy, and we're all going to go back to sucking the marrow out of bones. This really is a unique place in time, considering all the concerns of the last few decades, where you have a convergence of a variety of technologies, whether it's the ability to access previously inaccessible legacy fuel systems, fuel resources such as oil and gas, is meeting up with tremendous gains in efficiencies of all appliances and machines that use power, to alternative methods become more and more affordable so you can have a blended system. In the last decade alone, there's been a revolution in solar power and its affordability and its productivity, which blends well with natural gas, and that when the sun goes down, you can then pump into the grid other things. I still think nuclear power catches a bad rap, but if anybody wanted to build them, there's also some great capabilities there, clean coal, et cetera, that the diversity you have in energy sources, you know, begs the question that a lot of our priorities from a national security arena have to do with the free flow of petroleum products and hydrocarbons around the globe to maintain economies. If you get a combination of efficiencies and diversity that allows local production and use of energy, you know, how does that change everybody's calculus? Whereas Iranian Saudi conflict circa 1985 would have a different impact on the global economy than one in 2025. I think that's fascinating. I don't think that there's been enough. It's moved so fast that I think in the back of my mind, I'm thinking our national security calculus hasn't quite caught up with the new reality of global energy production.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And the question is, you know, if all the presence we have in the Middle East, we keep a carrier on station, we do all this stuff, we've got all these allies that are not necessarily nice people, but, you know, what if you could, if you just say, you know, we don't need you anymore. We can walk away from you, and if you guys want to destroy yourselves, have at it. You know, certainly it's an approach, you know, or is it part of our obligation as a major maritime power to ensure that no matter who's involved, that we want the free flow of commerce on the world's oceans. So including things like the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. I mean, where do we draw the line on what's in our national interest? And I think that question, the national interest question, is one that really needs to be addressed, and it needs to be addressed pretty soon, because we're I'm really excited as a former oil and gas company guy, really excited about where we are with our national energy. And as you say, at some price, you know, you're a finance kind of guy, economic kind of guy, at some price, energy is fungible. You know, whether it's nuclear power or whatever, there is some cost at which it is justified. So right now, we should exploit our oil and gas stuff, but we should be looking ahead to at what, you know, lowering the cost of nuclear power. They had all these, for a while, there were all these discussions of mini nuclear power plants. So you didn't have to have, you know, Three Mile Island type things. They were much smaller plants that were you could put in place. You never even had to go inside the things. So I don't know what happens to all that, but, you know, there is some cost price at which all that stuff replaces. If we took the total cost of what it takes to get oil to us, including the cost of having the national defense, our national defense assets deployed to all these unpleasant places far, far away, and the amount of money we spend to try and keep them supplied and try and turn these recalcitrant countries into democracies, as we understand the term.
Yeah, I got a real kick out of, you know, talk about people who are locked in the past. Well, first of all, I because of where I grew up and a variety of other things, I have, and a lot of my biases were created via growing up with the children of Cuban refugees. I could talk for hours just what my friends' fathers and mothers went through. We also have, over the course of the last 10 to 15 years, we've had a lot of the best and brightest in heck, just regular Joes, great barbers, by the way, from Venezuela that have come up here. And one of the underreported things going on that's actually kind of sad is what's going on as the usual results of socialist economic and political policy come to their fruition. One of the apparatchiks in the Venezuelan government said, "We hope the U.S. Marines don't dare come here. We'll defeat them." And it just goes, "You know, lady, we don't want anything that you've got." Venezuela is no longer worth the bones of any American. The oil they produce in Venezuela is very, very heavy. Very few refineries outside the U.S. can do anything with it. The Chinese have sunk billions of dollars into it. That's fine. That means it's billions of dollars they haven't sunk someplace else. I feel very sorry for the Venezuelan people. But the world's changed. And part of that change is backwards economies with suboptimal petroleum products like Venezuela. People will let you just wallow in your misery and throw rocks at each other. You look next door in Colombia, similar demographics, similar locations, et cetera, and so forth. Colombia is a modern, advancing nation that's taking advantage of the best fruits of the Enlightenment and free enterprise, as is Chile, and pluses or minuses. And plus, Colombians just got rid of the FARC. Maybe. Congratulations to them. While Venezuela, I don't know the end game there, but I know it doesn't involve U.S. Marines. If the Venezuelans are lucky, the Brazilians and the Colombians will find some way to help them out when they bottom out. But I think Venezuela has got a way to go before they finally bottom out. Unfortunately for them, just like in Cuba, a lot of their intellectual capital is now in Florida, Texas, Georgia, Virginia, et cetera, and so forth.
Well, that does raise, as we get along in the show here, that does raise the issue of whether or not there's going to be a humanitarian crisis down there. I mean, there already seems to be one, but is there going to be one such that by the time the media gets a hold of it, we're going to be looking at trying to do something to help these people out? Or is it this a case where, you know, they've allowed this socialist state to do whatever it's done to them, and should we just kind of sit and wait and see what happens until somebody asks us politely to come down and help?
Yeah, I think it's going to have to be the latter. We're going to have to go in and help. I think ultimately we should try to change the dynamic. for reasons good, bad, or neutral. I think good people can argue both sides of the equation. Central and South America has in their national culture and identity the fact that the Anglos from up north have a habit of interfering in their business. This might be an opportunity to help break that historical theme that keeps interfering with our ability to work together as nations, where when Venezuela reaches its ultimate end, let their neighbors take care of it. And then when they want us to help out, we can help them out with money, with food, diplomatic cover, things of that manner. But to be really far in the background, where we're seeing helping South Americans take care of a South American problem. And I think that might be in the long run, if you want to be strictly selfish about it, the long run strategic benefit to the U.S. to help show that we're not going to come in and tell you how to run your life. But if you decide that you want to run your life in a good direction, we'll be there to help you and your friends out. That might be a better way than having the Second Fleet set up shop there outside their capital.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well,
hey,
there
we
go.
It'd be in the hour.
We have pretty much killed this hour, yes.
Yeah. I think you had a point to make that I stepped on. What you got there?
Oh, I don't know. Let's see. No, I think I was just trying to connect the world. How much of the world that we know now was driven by energy, and how that's changed since the U.S. has developed a lot of these new technologies that allowed us to, I think, really become energy independent. We haven't even looked at the vast amounts of stuff that is available in Alaska now. So,
it's. You know, if people want to stop looking and picking at the apocalypse of the moment, it's a very exciting time to be in the energy sector. It's a really exciting time to look in, especially when you look at parts of the world that don't have a lot of natural resources that are trying to claw their way into some middle-income status, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa, which is another show all into itself. But there are lots of exciting options out there to help give these economy, these people, the energy they need to try to improve their life. It's a good news thing. I think the future every day gets further and further away from Soylent Green and the energy death of the world than a lot of people realize. Something I want to think about more is how far behind that movement is the national security mindset. What are some things that we should be thinking about differently? Because that is unquestionably a rapidly changing reality.
Yeah, and the other one, again, this is another topic maybe for a show down the road again, but we really need to talk about, the depletion of the ocean's assets, fishing, and all that stuff, that drives a lot of other issues, and is a national security issue when you get down to it. Because when you raise Soylent Green, I thought, oh yeah, except we've got to feed all these people, and a lot of them are dependent on stuff from the oceans, and we've got some bad actors out there who aren't really playing friendly with all of the rest of us.
Yeah, there's I'll recommend this book to everybody just because I don't read all the books I wish I had time to. But there's a great book out here that addresses just that topic, The Unnatural History of the Sea by Callum Roberts. Yeah.
Sounds good.
Okay. Hey, for some reason, we got a weird loop in there. I'm hearing you again. Well, hey, I'll tell you what. Thanks a lot, Eagle One. It's been a pleasure. And I think that's coming from me. I brought up the window to get the title of the book. But it's been a pleasure this hour. I hope everybody has a great July 4th weekend. And I guess we'll see you the weekend after that.
Yeah, thanks for everybody for showing up and just listening to a couple old guys babble, and look forward to talking to all of you again in a couple of weeks.
Yes, sir. Thanks a lot, and thanks a lot for all of our listeners, especially those that have been with us for 7.5 years. Hope you have a July 4th weekend that we can all be happy with, and have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
It's a long way to Tipperary.